It's Wednesday, September 16, 2020, just after market close in London. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington, joined shortly by our managing editor, Roger Hurst. But first, an unscripted daily briefing with Haley Drasnan. Haley, welcome back.
Hey, Ash, good to be here.
Haley, what are you looking at today?
Retail sales were out this morning, and spending appears to have grown at a slower pace in August than prior summer months, you know, a tepid 0.6% versus the expected 1% high that we, you know, we were planning on seeing. And I think this highlights the consumer spending patterns that we're seeing. You know, the federal relief bill for unemployed people dried up a bit, and Americans are spending less. They have less in their wallets, and you know that's reflecting this number. And we did, when looking closer at the numbers, did see a boost in clothing, in furniture, in electronics, and I think this might be a result of this like confusing school year that we're starting.
Yeah, you know, exactly to your point. So retail sales up 0.6%, consensus range 0.2 to 2.5%. So toward the lower end of the range. And most intriguingly, perhaps, prior month, 1.2%. So roughly a 50% fall off of the rate of increase in the retail sales number from last month. Looking a little deeper into the data, X vehicles, it's a little bit stronger, 0.7%.
And, you know, equity markets are up despite these slower retail numbers. And I think it goes to show that the markets aren't so sensitive to economic data as much these days. You know, at the time we're filming this, we're waiting on the Fed. And also, you know, investors in the coming weeks are waiting to see for another stimulus package out of Congress.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's even too, you're putting it too charitably, Haley. It's the markets are just totally disconnected from anything that seems to be happening with the real economy.
It's this juxtaposition we've been covering between the real economy and the markets that, you know, we'll continue to cover in the coming months.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Haley, what else are you looking at?
So more on the U.S. equity market. You know, we're seeing a surge in IPOs this week. Take Snowflake, for example, the cloud-based data company. It debuted today and more than doubled its opening price. I think at $245, it shared and it was listed at $120. So incredible to see that investors want more high-growth stocks than the FANGs that have rallied so far this year.
Yeah, so obviously we're recording here at about 2 p.m. Eastern time, so some time left before the end of the trading day. Your mileage may vary.
It's hard to believe given the pandemic, but 2020 is proving to be one of the biggest money-raising years for new issues since the tech boom, you know, 20 years ago. And I think a lot of it has to do with this new Fed policy and the idea that there are very few places for investors to park capital outside of equities. And, you know, companies really seem to be racing to IPO under this premise.
Yeah, I think that's a really great metaphor. We've talked about this before. This does harken back to the tech boom when I was one of the young guys on Wall Street. You know, just reading through, doing a little bit of research on Snowflake coming in here, it really is like a checklist of all of the buzzwords we had. Let's see. We got AI, we got big data, data lake, data exchange, cloud, cloud compute, software as a service, services revenue. It really does check every box in this particular domain of stocks that are hot. Look, it's important to realize that this is a story that's very different than Nikola, which we talked about yesterday. You know, last year, the company revenue rose 174% to $265 million. So over a quarter of $1 billion in revenue, fastest growing business application in 2019, according to data from Okta. They're raising $3.5 billion, total valuation of $33 billion. And I think one of the more intriguing factors that has gotten market attention is Warren Buffett, who has historically been allergic to tech stocks, has been allergic to companies that he doesn't understand, is investing hundreds of millions of dollars into this company.
Yeah, it's amazing. Snowflake's CEO is selling half of his 8 million shares to Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. And as you said, you know, this typically isn't in Buffett's playbook, so it's definitely making it attractive.
Yeah. It's an interesting story, too. Look, I don't want to get too far over my skis here. It's been a long time since I've been in the tech space. But the company does something that's really interesting. You know, effectively what they're doing is they're doing cloud database services that make that allow for more more virtualized data analytics. And basically what that means is they're disaggregating the data layer from the compute or analytics layer, and they're framing it in a way so that you can get more software, more hardware, analyzing and churning through this data. So it is very much a very kind of 2020 story.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Not a lot of competition except Oracle and Amazon's Redfish.
I would be willing to bet that Mr. Bezos and Mr. Ellison are going to be investing more capital in this space very shortly.
As I always say, we'll keep our eye on it.
Well, there's a lot to keep an eye on. Haley Drasnan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ash.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Roger Hurst, welcome back.
Hi, Ash. Good to be here.
It's been a few weeks.
It has. I think 2, maybe 3 weeks, and it's been quite a dramatic couple of weeks in many ways, at least in the U.S. equity market.
Yeah. Roger, exactly to that point, the three things that have been on my mind, options, options, options. You know, you've been so eloquent in explaining this on the Refinitiv channel that's partnered with Real Vision, and I thought that this would be a great opportunity to have you unpack a little bit about how you see the world and how the fundamentals of this market work.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things. Obviously, everyone talks about the options whale, and I think that the whale with SoftBank has been perhaps less of an influence. It's certainly been in there, but it's maybe been a follower rather than the driver. And I've called it it's the retail, it's been the megalodon of the market. So the retail meg, they've been the real drivers of this. And they've been driving, I mean, it's been incredible size. I mean, you know, we've seen the notional of options has got to 140% of the cash market. 3 years ago, that used to be around about 40%. So these are huge numbers. But what's been really fascinating is that the size of the options contracts have generally been under 50 lots. Mm. So 50 lots is 5,000 shares. So 100 shares per contract, 50 lots is 5,000 shares or under. So they've been trading little and often. Whereas the options whale, it looks like they were doing largely call spreads and often doing them delta neutral because I think they were selling out of stock positions and buying call spreads. So if you're doing that, you're having less impact on the direction and also you're having less impact on the absolute volatility. But the retail guys, they've been in size, they've been buying calls, which means they're buying volatility. And because of the market makers who are selling them the calls have to buy the stock as a hedge, they've been pushing the market up. So there's been this options-led equity exuberance. But I think the other thing that I've been talking about is that it still feels like this is an unwind, or it's an exuberance on the upside and an unwind of exuberance to the downside, but it's basically an air pocket. And as yet, nothing obviously structural in what we're seeing. It's really dominated by those equities, in particular options on 7 mega cap tech stock, which are driving all that volume.
Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack there. You know, I find this absolutely fascinating. The real whale, or as you put it, the megalodon, isn't one particular institutional investor. It's your friends and neighbors who are actually participating in the option space in a way that they haven't in the past. But I want to jump to hearing you explain the significance and the mechanisms that this market worked by, because you've done such a great job on this. You mentioned Delta. We talked a little bit off camera in past about Gamma. Explain how these Greeks work and what the impact is on a relative and absolute basis to the U.S. equity market.
So the what these guys are doing is they're tending, the majority of what they're buying is are options with less than 2 weeks to expire. So an options contract is a bit like insurance. You buy insurance for a year, once it runs out, you have to renew. Well, these are options that only have 2 weeks to run. And we've got the big expiry is actually on Friday of this week. So, you know, you have these triple, you have the quarterly expiries, which are March, June, September, December with the big volume. So what generally happens is that you get closer to that expiry. The natural thing is that Gamma picks up. If you've got, you know, if this is expiry, if you're at the money, then the gamma required increases as you go to expiry. And the reason behind that is that, you know, if you're 2 months away or more than 2 weeks away, you buy an at the money option. So stock is at 100, strike it is 100. You probably have to have a 50 delta hedge. But let's say you're on the day of expiry. Now, this is an extreme example. As a market maker who sold that call, if it's at 101, you have to deliver all the stock. If it's at 99, you have to deliver nothing. So if that stock starts moving around, the market maker conceivably have to buy 100, sell 100, buy 100, sell 100. In reality, they don't do that. They manage themselves where they might pin the stock above or below the strike. But anyway, that's the gamma that picks up. Now, what we've been seeing is this upward pressure as we got closer to the September expiry, as we move through these strikes, as you get close to the strikes, close to expiry, the number of stocks that you have to buy per unit of underlying increases and increases. And it sort of goes like this, like this, like this, and then goes, boom, straight through. And Raoul used to call these the gamma hammer. You buy these positions and it would wham through. And this was kind of, you know, a great way of playing these opportunities. At the end of 1999, myself and Raoul were doing this, and we saw it in the French market, which expired at the end of the year, whereas everything else was at third Friday. And for what that the French market, when everyone's away, we saw it happening into the end of 99. So that's what we've been seeing here. But it's been led by these retail guys buying these, just buying long calls, not hedged. Market maker sells a call, buy some stock against it. And as the market moved up, they had to buy. And it all works in reverse. You eventually go blast through all your gamma, blast all your hedges, runs out of steam, loses momentum and reverses, and then the same thing happens in reverse, which is what we've been seeing for the last 2 weeks. I think a lot of this will disappear after the September expiry. This is the triple witching, quadruple witching in the US, where you get index options, single stock options, options on the futures, although there's no volume there, and the futures themselves all expire either in the morning in the index level or a single stock at the end of the day. And it happens in Europe as well.
Yeah. I mean, the mechanics of the way this works are so crucial to understanding the market and the gyrations that we've seen. You know, as you said, it increases volatility around particular expiry periods that have nothing to do with, you know, anything that's fundamental, for example, with earnings or with macroeconomic fundamentals.
Yeah, and we've seen this before. I mean, the you may recall back in March, and again, I never made any predictions. So before someone says you didn't say that, I said there is, you've got to watch for expiries because you get inflection points regularly. When you get a big move into and around an expiry, you often get an inflection point. And at the time I said, look, remember, the low of December 2018 was the first trading day after the December expiry, which was Christmas Eve. The low of the March sell-off, COVID sell-off, was the day after the March expiry. It was, the expiry was on the 21st, the second, Monday the 24th, sorry, it was the 20th, Monday the 23rd was the low. We had the package from the Fed as well, but that was also a low. A week and a half before the June expiry, we had the 5% air pocket. 2 weeks before this expiry, we just had a 10% air pocket on the NASDAQ. They should be critical to people's thinking. They don't define the direction, but they can accelerate the direction of the market in both directions because of the inventory management that has to go on around them. So I always just say, look, you know, be aware that we're coming up to one and we've got the September expiry on Friday of this week. That will, we've probably seen a lot of gamma now moving out of the market. The shortest dated options really now are 1 month from here, so the October expiry. So it just changes that dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, and talking of the air pocket, Roger, you were ahead of the curve on that. And for viewers who watch the Refinitiv show, they got that ahead of when it actually happened in terms of your, I don't want to call it a forecast, but your analysis of what had potentially been lurking beneath the surface.
It was pure luck, obviously, because we go out once a week, and the day we go out is normally a Wednesday. We went actually this week, and it happened that the Wednesday was the day before the sell-off kicked in. But we actually said the week before that, we'd said, look, we can see that data usage is ridiculously low. People are away from their desks. Implied volatility is very, very high. The market realized volatility was very, very low. So volatility was expensive, driven by two things, retail buying it, but also as we're getting closer and closer to the election, you know, you've got this incredible bump in the VIX curve. 5 months ago, you're a long way out, but as you get closer, you're moving up the curve. So the October VIX future is currently around about 30. So when September expires, we roll on to October, VIX will go up again just because we're going up that curve. So those were really driving. And I just said, look, this is an air pocket waiting to happen. I don't think it'll be a structural move. I think it will be an air pocket move. And that's what we've got. And you know, on the other side of this, the other bit of this is obviously the options whale. But the options whale has been buying these call spreads. So you buy, let's say you've got a strike of 100 again. They're buying the 105. They're selling the 110. The 105 might need, you know, might need a 20 delta hedge. And The 110 might need a 5 delta hedge. You've got a 15 delta. It's a smaller delta, less impact on the market. If they're selling the stock against it anyway, it's neutral. And then there's only a small amount of vol impact. So I don't think they're having the big impact here. I just think it's the retail. And they're just doing it in this incredible size. I mean, they've got the momentum trade. They've got the wind behind their backs, and they're doing it. And I think it's sort of, you know, it's an exuberance. But I don't think there's a structural risk because they're playing it from the long side. Yes, they might be using all their savings. Yes, they might even be using leverage, which would be a bit of a worry. If you're long premium, right, you can only lose your premium and no more. It might be all your savings, but that's all you can lose.
Roger, you just mentioned that you didn't think that this was anything more than really an air pocket in the market. Why do you think that?
There's a couple of things at this stage. The first one was that when we look at something like credit spreads, now the credit market is obviously being deformed by the activists of the central bank who are buying corporate bonds. But when I looked at something like the 5-year credit swap, so this is the index, it's got a nice little sort of coincidental pattern with the VIX. When we saw the VIX going up with this latest move, so we did see vol picking up a little bit, VIX spiked, but the credit derivative index didn't. And now VIX has gone up and it's moved back down again. So there wasn't a big threat coming from the credit market. Now, the problem with this is that the credit market's not giving good signals because it's a deformed market by the central banks. Then the second element to it, although as well, was that we could look at HYG, which is the high yield ETF, and LQD, which is the investment grade one. And those peaked and then have been flatlining for actually more than a month. The S&P had been, again, following that in the recovery and then had this spike up in the last kind of the 2 weeks before the air pocket, and the air pocket back down. So again, the S&P went through a round trip whilst the high yield and the investment grade did nothing. And then the third thing is vol. And this is the key thing, which is volatility of volatility. So options on the VIX, volatility of volatility. When things get really hairy, often the volatility of volatility really goes up. And that's when you have these structural short positions. And we had that in Volmageddon in 2018. There was a massive short vol, structural short vol position, yield enhancement. When that moved, when the market moved, vol exploded higher. Over the next 2 years, it built up again. So that when we had the March implosion, vol exploded higher. This time round on this move, vol has been very, very well behaved. It hasn't moved aggressively. And again, it's because this market has been driven by the retail from the long side buying options, driving the market up, driving volatility up, plus that election impact. And you can see this with Apple. Apple price up, the Apple VIX, AAPLVIX on Bloomberg, for instance, moved up as well. And then when Apple sold off, Apple VIX sold off because people are now locking in their profits and selling options. So again, it shows you that there's not that massive structural short that can often unwind positions. You know, 1987, people sold puts all the way up. So when the market collapsed, those puts got blown out and you had unlimited losses. This time round, it's being driven from the long side where as long as they're not using leverage in their margin account to buy the premiums, they're limited to losses on those premiums only. So it's the structure is less critical. I still think the next phase for the market is the structural one on insolvency. Yeah. So we might get the insolvency, but if the market is saying no problem because the credit spreads are still very, very well behaved, then you know we haven't got a structural problem yet.
So, Roger, when you talk about the risk of insolvency, what are you looking at as a future proxy of whether or not that may be on the horizon?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it's the credit market, you know. But that's a big, large cap credit market. Now, can you have? Well, let me put it another way. One of the big issues that I have for the long term health of this market is that large cap companies that should be going under are not going to go under because their bonds are going to be bought by the central bank through QE, and you know we know that they're buying corporate bonds, mortgages, and government bonds. But the smaller end of the market, you know, the mama and papa businesses, small private businesses, restaurants, they're all going under. So we're seeing a pickup in insolvency at the micro level, but we're seeing an impact or a pickup in zombie companies at the large cap level. Both of these are bad. Eventually, if you have real problems at the micro level, it will feed through to even lower revenues at the macro level, but continue to buy their corporate bonds from the central banks or potential of it, credit spreads, the market is not giving us a negative signal. If, however, the problem with the Fed is that the Fed told us they were going to buy them, they go classic, you know, bluff, the market then bought them. So we're now where we are in terms of tightness of credit and where we are on high yield and investment grade. If real trouble kicks in, The market will sell all its inventory to the Fed, who will use up its $2.3 trillion on buying back from the market. Then it'll have to do another $2.3 trillion because we're now back down again. So that's the never-ending cycle that we get into, but that's not happening just yet. The problem that we've got is a pickup in zombies. It's happening in Europe. It will happen in the US, which means the more zombies you have, the worse future growth will be, the lower the velocity of capital, or at least the misallocation of capital will continue, and therefore we'll still have the same problems in 5 years' time of no growth, probably no inflation that we really want. We'll still have asset price inflation, but not economic inflation, true growth.
Yeah, Roger, talk a little bit more about these zombie companies. Obviously, the idea that these companies need bailouts in order to function, they're not functioning in an economically efficient way. It creates all kinds of structural imbalances in the economy. How do you think about that, and what are you watching?
So it's just a low-growth story. It's basically what we want with capital is we want capital to find what we want for a strong economy is we want capital to find productive means look for innovation, look for productivity gains. But we're in a world where if you're looking at a world where yields and growth expectations are subdued, and when we look at things like inflation expectations, so five years, so I've talked about these before, I think it's FWISUS, 5.5 in the US and similar in Europe. They went down, obviously, they come back up to roughly where they were before. But the problem is those are still low levels. If you as an investor think that there's no growth for the next 10 years, but you see the equity market going up 10% every year, you do buybacks. You take your money and you don't put it into productive capital. You don't use it sensibly. Or well, actually, you do use it sensibly because you can get money, but the share buybacks is where you're doing well. But it means there's no capital being put into future growth. So future growth remains benign. So we roll on. We've basically thrown a whole bunch of capital away again. We're at the same position that we were 2008, in March of this year. Who knows when it'll be? Maybe it's already starting. But what we want to see is, are we going to see, or can we have unlimited support? What is the tenacity of fiscal plus the central banks? Is it QE infinity? Is it fiscal infinity, i.e. is it MMT? Or is there a point where they go, it's death by 1,000 cuts. Death by 1,000 cuts could be months or years in the making. So it's a slow process. You really want to look at the credit spreads, but the credit spreads are being artificially held down by the central banks.
Right. That's very well said, Roger. And it exists at a couple of different levels. You know, as you said, it's productive at the microeconomic level for the investor in terms of a productive use of capital. But in the broader sense, what you have is massive misallocation of resources. You have the productive uses of the economy not being funded properly. And you have zombie companies that are sucking out the capital that could be spent effectively building a more productive and in some senses a more just economy for the future.
Yeah, I mean, we've got banks that are too big to fail, that are regulated to buggery, but at the same time are protected. But we've got fintech coming through. More importantly, we've got other digital forms of capital and currency coming through as well, which should be disrupting it much more quickly, but they're being kept alive. And what banks should have done over the last 10 years is invest in technology, but none of them did, which is why the value propositions where you can't unlock the cap, can't unlock the value. And this is happening across the board in a lot of the old world economy stocks. And the most classic one is where you had a lot of the classic value stocks, which had debt added to them by private equity, who then pulled out dividends to increase their own cash flow, at the same time saddled these guys with loads of debts. And they're in parts of the economy which weren't growing particularly rapidly. You want these companies to go under. I don't mean it in a nasty way, because you don't want to see people lose their jobs. But it's a bit like the UK mining industry. It was protected. There was massive strikes in the early 80s. They were being subsidized by the rest of the UK because they were non-profitable. And we didn't want to, there's this thing, we don't want these mining communities, working class communities, to be broken up. But they unfortunately needed to be broken up so that the UK could move on and become productive again, rather than throwing money away onto industries that were inefficient. Right. And that's what we have. You've got inefficient industries, you need creative destruction, you rejuvenate, and you come out with new technology. But if new technologies can't compete with old technologies, which are being given unlimited capital because they can tap these ridiculous capital markets where anyone wants a yield of 25 basis points over treasuries, so 1%, then they continue for a long time and they don't, their day of reckoning doesn't come. Look at Japanese banks. They should have blown up in the 90s, but they're still just muddling along here 30 years later.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Yeah, it really is a paradox. You know, I'm reminded many years ago when Microsoft was the most innovative and cutting edge tech company on the West Coast. Bill Gates was asked in an interview if he was worried about what IBM was going to do or DEC or one of the old world behemoths. And he said, absolutely not. I worry about what is going to be created in the garage. I worry about the 20-something year old folks who are going to be innovating me out of business. And that's absolutely proven to be the case. And this challenge of zombie companies, you know, in effect, has the ability to suck the capital away from the most innovative and productive uses of the economy. Although I guess you could argue that VC has stepped in to fulfill that role. But it is very much a paradox and a challenge in how you deal with the impact that this disruption, the creative destruction that Joseph Schumpeter called it, has on the lives of individuals and communities. There really are no easy answers.
No, we've got to always rejuvenate. We've always got to hope that we can push forward. Now, a lot of this is clearly demographics as well, so that's part of the mix. The demographics are peaking, then you know, things like, you know, GDP growth, which is mainly a function of demographics and a bit of productivity. Well, if you don't have the demographics and the productivity is flatlining, then you're going to struggle. And effectively, that's what we were. We got overladen, overburdened with debt, as what we're trying to do is maintain a rate of change of the standard of living. And the rate of change of the standard of living reached its natural conclusion and was replaced with debt to keep it going.
Right.
So effectively, if we could have a concept, it's a ridiculous concept in a way, but a natural rate or an optimal rate of demand, it's organic, where we went beyond that through using debt. Problem is, once you start down that route, if you stop adding more debt, you feel worse off because it's all relative. The rate of change of standard of living peaks and rolls over, so we add yet more debt. And we've got ourselves locked into this system now where we actually would like, what we should have is a cost of capital that's freely floating, which is not if you've got QE or yield curve control, which are sort of two versions of the same thing. We don't know where capital should be. Probably interest rates should be higher, but we're now in a system which can't deal with higher interest rates because there's so much debt. So we're locked in it.
Yeah. You know, demography, standard of living, productivity. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about what's happening with Brexit.
So it's back on the cards again. I mean, it was never going away, but you know, like everything else, COVID has been just all consuming that it's taken a back seat. But now we've got a very, very limited time frame. We've got to have a deal agreed by the 15th of October, ratified by the 31st of December. And it's looking like there's a chance of, I call it a clean Brexit because, you know, I don't want to, I'm going to sit on the fence a little bit here, but you often hear about people falling out of Europe and there's negative connotations. The reality is that if we have no deal, it's a clean Brexit. We're on our own. Now, that is normally where, you know, when we've been pricing this before, and this is purely taking a view on the market. When it's looked like we're getting a deal, we've been up in the 130s on sterling, and it looks like we're going to fall out, clean Brexit, we're more like 120. We were 134 about a week ago. We got down to 127-ish. So the market's pricing it in. The risk reversal, this is buying puts on sterling versus dollar, massively increased 2.5 vol points over the last 2 weeks. And if you look at sterling volatility versus G3 volatility, again, very, very big spike in sterling versus the others. So we're starting to price in the chance that we have a clean Brexit. And to add into the mix as well from that is that one of the big arguments for why Brexit, why we get a deal is that places like Germany export so much to us. They don't get a deal, Germany will be upset. Problem is, with the COVID crisis, German exports to the UK have fallen off a cliff over the last 6 months. So they've already had a dry run. Germany knows what it's like to not export so much to us. So there's less urgency for Germany to demand that the rest of Europe falls in line with a deal because of German exports. So I think there is now a much, much bigger risk that we get a clean Brexit. But I'm not so bothered about that, because the great thing about having sovereignty over your currency in a world where volumes look like they could fall further is that you can adjust your currency.
Right.
So yes, if sterling falls to 120 or below, it has inflationary impacts for the UK, which imports quite a lot. And that will hit, unfortunately, certain parts of the poorer parts of the population again. But the UK currency is an adjustment function. And in times of adversity, you want that. Europe doesn't have that. Italy can't do that. We can't. So I'm looking and thinking, okay, well, you know, if we go to parity versus the dollar, rather than go, oh my God, we're a weak country, you could actually say, well, we've got an adjustment mechanism. And there's going to be a point where people go, God, dollar parity with sterling, euro parity with sterling. Every asset in the UK now looks cheap. Let's pile in.
Yeah.
Self-regulating mechanism. So I'm kind of, is it going to be worse than what we had during the COVID crisis? No. And I think that's why the UK and the press and everybody is a little bit sort of not that bothered, because it's not going to be as worse as being locked down for 3 months.
Roger, can I get a better deal on an apartment in London than in New York? Is that possible?
Not at the moment, because London prices have not fallen quite so dramatically. They're falling, but they're not falling that much. It's, London at the end of the day, and I was back in there last, I've had 2 days in there. Definitely the trip in and out, a lot more people. Still, the city of London is incredibly quiet still, remarkably so. Once you get out of the financial district, there's a bit of life to the old lady at the moment. So, things are picking up.
Interesting. Roger, I'm so glad you brought up the city of London. In reference to Brexit, you have obviously a deep and wide network of connections in the city of London from your days in banking at Deutsche Bank, at Goldman Sachs and others. What's the pervasive feeling among people who are working in the financial services community about where we are right now in Brexit? What's the unofficial word that you hear when you're sitting in a pub?
I think it's almost sort of the risk or the likelihood that we just leave is going up. I mean, there's all this shenanigans about going back on the laws or the legal aspects that we'd all agreed.
Mm.
But I just think that there was Brexit fatigue already. There's now COVID fatigue. There's this sort of general feeling that it won't be so bad either way because of what we've been through. So for people who really wanted the clean version of Brexit, it's got a lot higher chance of happening. And I think there's going to be fewer people against it, because is it really worse than what we've experienced through the COVID scenario? So that's really, I think, is really driving it. And I think it's kind of, let's move on. There are worse things to worry about now.
Yeah, interesting and very well said. Roger, final thoughts as you look at this complex landscape, volatility, COVID, Brexit, what are you going to be looking at as you go forward? And how are you thinking about that future?
I'm still looking at the same things I've probably mentioned every time we've come on, which is the dollar's moved, and the dollar's moved versus the euro and G10, but primarily against the euro. And the euro moved, remember, it moved higher, 112 to 120 on the back of agreeing the deal. This was a euro story. Normally, when the dollar's on the back foot, it's led by emerging market currencies, which have a higher beta. Emerging market currencies diverged from the euro G10 currencies as well. And I'd still like to see, if we're really going to see dollar weakness, the EMFX have to join that party, strength in EMFX. But we're still seeing a lot of these currencies on the back foot. I know Turkey has lots of idiosyncratic problems, but it's like in 2008, there was an idiosyncratic problem in Ireland, in Iceland, in Portugal. But they're all the same thing in the end. They were just different manifestations of the same issue. So that could still happen. So I'm still looking at that. And I think that, we started to see the European policymakers worrying that the euro at 120 is bad. We've got problems, or Europe is at flat inflation, CPI zero versus the US getting a bit. So So how do they hit that? They're going to worry. Problem for Europe is they've shot their bolt on the package. They've just got the frugal five to agree. They're not going to get another big package now. And there's not much more they can do on the monetary side apart from, oh, we're going to double down on QE. But that's the area. It's the currencies. And that's the biggest escape valve. You've got corporate bonds that are being, if corporate bonds are being bought up by central banks, if government bonds are being bought up by central banks, if equities in Japan are being bought up by central banks, you don't have many release valves. Currency is the one where we can probably see it. It's still being manipulated. You know, they don't want Europe to go too far. But it's the currency where we can still see that. And I think that for Europe, it will become a problem if the euro strengthens too much. There's probably a little bit more upside maybe. But I think, again, these things balance themselves out. I'm not a massive, not as bullish on the dollar as I was, but I'm not massively bearish because Japan and Europe can't let their currencies strengthen too much because it'll massively impact their policies, which is print, 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 get inflation by weakening the currency. It's going to balance itself out. But watching the currencies, that's the release valve on the macro front when everything else is being impacted by central banks intervening in those markets.
Roger, an important point and great insight as always. Thanks for joining us.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.